May it please the court, I will be arguing the point on which the court granted transfer, and standing on the briefs as submitted with respect to the remaining points in appellant's brief. The issue which this court has been asked to resolve is whether the double jeopardy clause is violated by Mr. Smith's conviction of count 3 of assault in the first degree, count 4 of armed criminal action, where his conviction of those two counts is predicated upon proof of the same conduct for which he was convicted in count 1 of murder in the first degree and count 2 of assault, of count 2 of armed criminal action. Mr. Smith argues that double jeopardy is violated, and that is because the two counts, counts 3 and 4, are lesser included offenses of counts 1 and 2. Now, in analyzing whether or not double jeopardy is violated, this court must first look to the statutes under which Mr. Smith was convicted. If the particular statutes under which he was convicted specifically authorize cumulative punishment in this situation, then those particular statutes, statutory authority, is to be followed. For instance, the second degree murder statute, section 565.021, specifically authorizes cumulative punishment for the underlying felony and for the death or any death that would occur during the perpetration or attempted perpetration or flight from any felony that was committed. But there is no such specific authorization in any of the statutes that are at issue here. There is no authorization in 565.050, the assault statute, none in the murder first statute, 565.020, and none in the armed criminal action statute, 571.015. The law states that when the statute doesn't specifically state that cumulative punishment is authorized, then this court must then next look to section 556.041. And section 556.041 provides that when the same conduct of a person may establish the commission of more than one offense, that person cannot be convicted of both offenses if one of the offenses is a lesser included of the other. And we argue that is the situation that you have in this particular case, and that assault in the first degree is a lesser included offense of murder in the first degree. It is impossible to commit murder first without having committed assault in the first degree. Assault in the first degree is committed when one attempts to kill, knowingly causes, or attempts to cause serious physical injury. Obviously, in order to cause the type of injury that would result in a fatality, one would have to attempt to kill or knowingly cause or attempt to kill to cause serious physical injury.
I understand your argument if they had alleged attempt to kill assault of Mr. Williams and the death of Mr. Williams, or attempt to kill, you know, some other version of say Mr. Williams had died and they had alleged assault of Mr. Williams and death of Mr. Williams. But here we have a different victim. That is a difference between the two crimes.
That is a difference, and the state would be arguing that because there are two victims, we should be looking at the units of prosecution. But I would then turn back to 556.041, which specifically states that when one offense is a lesser included of the other.
Well, why is it lesser included if it's a different victim and killed a different person?
Well, it's a lesser included offense in this instance, because when you're evaluating whether or not double jeopardy is violated, based on this court's last opinion in Hardin, you would be looking at whether or not, in theory, the offenses are lesser included of one another.
And again, if it's a different person was killed, how is it a lesser included offense of assaulting? If you have two or three victims, why aren't those always, how could one ever be included in the other? Because you have a different element proving they killed someone else. I know it's a transferred intent case, but you still have to prove the victim, and that's and therefore killed the child who's at issue in this case.
Well, my response to that would be that under the current law in Hardin, you wouldn't be looking at the facts of the case. So irrespective of the fact that there were two victims, you would be analyzing the statutes on the theoretically whether or not assault in the first degree is a lesser included offense of murder in the first degree, without regard for whether, you know, there were two victims, without regard for how the particular offense was actually charged.
So if what you did was blow up a building and there were 10 people in it, it would be one crime. You were trying to injure a person you saw run in there, and 10 people happened to be in there, and they were all killed. It would be it would be a lesser included. And
well, I think that in that particular instance, you would be talking about different violations of the same statute.
Okay, well, let me make this hypothetical similar to Judge Tiss. I shoot at you, it goes through your heart and kills you, but it just injures the lady behind you.
Yes.
Okay, would that, under your argument, that would violate double jeopardy?
What would you,
if she dies, you say it doesn't violate double jeopardy because it's not a lesser, but if she doesn't die, under your argument, that would violate double jeopardy.
I think that in that particular situation, you would be talking about a conviction of two individuals. I mean, conviction for two victims under the same statute.
And why aren't
we here? In that particular instance, I believe that possibly the unit of prosecution would apply. But in this particular instance, the case that we're dealing with here, we're talking about conviction of two different statutes. And in that particular instance, the law states that the test to be applied is the same elements test, or the Blackburger test as it is otherwise known. And that is whether the offenses each have an element that the other does not.
So if you look at the Blackburger test and look at the elements of each of the first degree murder and assault, list for me the elements of each and let's see where they don't intersect.
Well, murder in the first degree is, you know, you knowingly cause the death of another person after deliberation on the matter.
Okay.
And assault in the first degree obviously includes terms that are not included in murder in the first degree.
What are those elements of assault?
Elements of assault, you would have to either attempt to kill. There are several different methods. You can either attempt to kill, that's one method, you knowingly cause, or you would attempt to cause serious physical injury.
But you're saying you just look at the theory. You don't look at that they're different victims or anything. You just look at if you were theoretically listing them, and you're leaving in the words a person, and therefore it doesn't matter that they were different people. It's the same crime.
Well, it was my understanding of this court's most recent opinion in Hardin was that you would be looking at the actual statutes themselves. Without regard for what the facts of the case were.
Can you quote from Hardin where you get that from, that you just look at a theoretical statement of a crime and not as to whether there were multiple injuries or multiple people harmed?
Well, that's what I understood from this court's latest opinion, was that how you were going to conduct the double jeopardy analysis, was without regard for how it is charged, what is stated in the jury instructions.
Without regard to who was injured, if there were multiple victims, did we say that in Hardin? You wouldn't look at whether there were multiple people harmed?
There was no specific language to that effect because that issue was not raised. And so that was not an issue in the Hardin case.
Counsel, let me back up just a second. Point one of your brief says the trial court clearly erred in refusing the self-defense instruction, right? And that's not the argument you're making now. Correct? This isn't the self-defense argument.
No, it is not the self-defense argument.
All right, then point two of your brief talks about the error between the written sentence and judgment and what was returned from the court and whether or not there were two convictions, whether or not the written judgment reflects the actions that occurred in court, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then I don't have any other points relied on. So is there a point relied on about this double jeopardy issue?
Yes, it is. This is the state's cross appeal. This is the state's...
Well, okay, but then I think you may want to discuss your issues as well before you run out of time. You may want to discuss your...
The state's cross appealing, though, the trial court said it was double jeopardy, and they cross-appealed that, and that's what you're addressing?
Yes. I wanted to address the double jeopardy issue because there are some things that I needed to address that are in the state's brief. I would respectfully stand on the brief with regard to the self-defense issue and the written sentence and judgment issue. I'm stating on record that I am not waiving those issues. I still want those issues considered by the court. But
the state conceded one of those issues, is that right?
Yes, it did. Moving to the things that I wanted to address, the state stated in its brief that assault in the first degree contains the element of purposely, and that murder in the first degree does not. I would like to respond to that and state, of course, that you can establish purpose through establishing knowingly. Purpose is included expressly in murder in the second degree, and murder in the second degree is a lesser included offense of murder in the first degree. So by implication, purposely is included within the offense of murder in the first degree. I'd also like to point the court to the Missouri approved instructions for murder in the first degree and murder in the second degree. Those Missouri approved instructions provide for inclusion on a paragraph instructing the jury to find that it was the defendant's purpose to cause the death of the victim. And that is included in the second paragraph in instructing on the element of knowingly causing the death. The next thing that I want to address is awareness. In the state's brief, it stated that you can be convicted of murder without being aware of the victim, whereas with assault, you cannot. I believe that this is a misstatement of the law in that if you are knowingly committing an offense, then you have to be aware of your conduct and aware that certain circumstances exist, such as the circumstance that that person might likely be within the area or present. The unit of prosecution, again, it's the legislative intent is not clear that the cumulative punishment is actually authorized in this case, and this court should not presume that it is, given that the defendant's liberty is at stake.
Thank you, counsel. You have some time on rebuttal.
Excuse me. I apologize for my voice today. May it please the court. This is a case where you have two different victims, and each victim is a separate element of proof under the multiple rulings of cases where the word another person is used. And I think those cases are cited in our brief. Certainly when there's a single statute, there's no dispute about that. Now, the question, one of the questions opposing counsel raises is whether if you have more than one statute, you still use the unit of prosecution test. And one indication of that would be the opinion of Judge Stith in the Liberty case, where she says to determine whether the legislature intended multiple punishments, a court first looks to the unit of prosecution allowed by the statutes, plural, under which the defendant was charged. And that's at page 547 of the Liberty case. So at least, there's at least some authority that says that units of, and really all it turns on is legislative intent, and units of prosecution and these other modes of analysis, such as the statutory elements test, are just ways of getting at what the legislature really intended. So that's one way of thinking about it, is that you have two different units of prosecution when there are separate victims under these statutes. The second, of course, is the statutory elements test. And the question here, there's no dispute, of course, that murder involves the death of the victim, so that's a separate element of murder. But is there a separate element of assault that's different from the mens rea of murder? And I think under the Hardin case, the test is whether it's impossible to commit one without committing the other. And the best illustration of that is a case like this, where you have an unintended victim. Because under murder in the first degree, intent transfers even if you don't know that the victim is there, such as in this case, where the victim is behind a bush. Nobody knew Janila Douglas was on the playground that day until the bullet hit her. At least the shooter didn't know. Now, in the case of first-degree assault, however, that requires what the Gonzalez case describes as proof of a very specific intent on the part of the actor to accomplish that objective, and discusses purposive conduct or specific intent rather than merely knowingly. And it points out, the Whalen case points out at page 187, that by contrast, the person will not be guilty of purposely causing or attempting to cause serious physical injury if the person is unaware of the likely presence of the injured person at the time the person acts, although the person may be guilty of criminally negligent or reckless conduct depending on the state of his knowledge. So you can't have an assault one without the specific intent to assault someone who you know is there. So that is the difference between the mens reas of murder one and assault one. And because the mens reas are different, the statutory elements are different. Because the statutory elements are different, the lesser included offense exception to the general rule that you can prosecute all crimes committed within a single transaction does not apply. And therefore, there was no double jeopardy in this case. I think that's the bulk of the argument. Another indication would be the McTush case, where this court said that if each offense requires proof of a fact that the other does not, then the offenses are not lesser included offenses. Now, one of the offenses required proof of if you have two different victims, then you have two different proofs of facts that are required in order to convict of both charges, at least in most cases. And if you're applying the statutory elements test, you apply it to whether it is impossible to commit the greater without committing the lesser. In fact, in Hardin, I believe that was a case where under the facts as charged, the same act applied to the same victim, yet there was no double jeopardy because you could have a case where the person could commit the act using a different method than what was used in that particular case. So
could the state have charged assault and a murder if Mr. Williams had died?
No, Your Honor.
And so can you address, opposing counsel believes that same rationale applies where it's a different victim. Can you address that argument? Assuming you're right that you couldn't, saying assault
sure.
would be a lesser included offense of
right.
murder. Do we only look at the statutory elements, or do we look at where do we get our authority to look at victims? Where there are multiple victims, then there's multiple crimes.
I think the case law is pretty consistent that where the words another person is used, those are different elements of proof. If the another person is a different person.
Mr. Barnes, would you respond to her argument that her client was entitled to a self-defense instruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
I believe the issue was simply not successfully injected into the case because none of the witnesses, no matter which witness you believe, including the defendant, you don't have enough evidence to inject the issue of self-defense. I think in a reply.
Well, what if the jury believed? What if the jury believed the statement that he said he made up?
Yes, and that statement did not inject self-defense either, because under that version of the statement, Martez Williams was the shooter and he was the person running away. And if Martez Williams was the shooter and he was the person running away, he didn't exercise self-defense because he didn't have a gun, he didn't shoot at him. He was merely the victim. He was running away, so you'd have a not guilty verdict rather than a self-defense defense. And that's the only one that even remotely, that's the only one that puts a gun in the hand of Martez Williams. Every other witness says that, including the defendant, says the defendant was the shooter. And the defendant, of course, swore under oath that statement wasn't true, told the police immediately that statement wasn't true. Defense counsel argued at the trial that wasn't what happened. So that did not successfully inject self-defense either because he didn't use self-defense under that particular statement. I could go on and
no
on.
No further questions?
I really don't.
Okay.
I think
all right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you for your efficient use of your time.
Ms. Robinson.
Counselor, what's the best evidence in the case that would support a version of the facts that the jury could have believed that your client was entitled to self-defense instruction? Is it the statement that the defendant said he made up?
No. The evidence, I think, would be that we have a statement that the alleged assault victim was armed. We have the initial aggression of the assault victim at the beginning, throwing down his hat. He was the one that engaged the fight. We have Mr. Smith stepping back from Mr. Williams, the alleged assault victim, indicating that he's withdrawing. He's not going to fight him. But Mr. Williams continuing to try to re-engage him despite other people's intervention, trying to intervene and stop the fight. We have testimony indicating that the shots were toward Mr. Williams. We also have testimony indicating that although Mr. Williams fled, that Mr. Williams turned around and possibly posed a separate threat to Mr. Smith before the second and third shots were fired.
But there's no evidence.
Is there one place in the record where a version of what we would think would support a self-defense instruction can be found, which you think best articulates the evidence that would support a self-defense instruction?
I don't think that testimony came from one individual or one witness. The defendant's testimony was that he was pretty much firing warning shots. But there was testimony from the officer about his statement. In his statement, he talked about him being armed. In his statement, he talked about him turning around doing what he believed to be arming himself after he fled and turned around. I believe that those statements would support the giving of a self-defense instruction. And there was at least enough to submit it to the jury for the jury to have before it the question of whether or not he had acted in self-defense. I do want to state no disrespect to the court earlier, and I'm glad that I did get a chance to address a self-defense as the court had requested. Are there any additional questions?
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.